bandwidth and hosting for Bagel Tech Photo is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting solutions.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first ever The Photo Show from the British Tech Network.
Well done.
Hey, thank you.
One take.
One done. One shot, Madden.
Three less than me.
Welcome to the... I nearly The new British Tech Network. There you go. And the show where we discuss the week's photography news and try and answer a few of our viewers' questions without making fools of ourselves. Joining me this week are the three bears of the photo world. Starting off with Chris Forsman.
I'm more of a cub, really.
In the Wonderland Zoo, there's a certain bear who...
Christopher.
Good morning.
Bright and early. No iPad yet.
No iPad yet.
Stop rubbing it in, you.
But it's out on the van.
It was just put on a van at the FedEx facility in Skokie, Illinois, half an hour ago.
Skokie, Illinois. So your town sounds so cool compared to ours, like Manchester.
Skokie sounds like they haven't made a road down the middle of it yet. That's silly. And I thought Skokie was in Indiana.
No.
No. There probably is a Skokie in Indiana. You've got repeats all over the place, haven't you?
We do have a few, yeah.
Now, Carl, I know why you...
That other voice we're hearing is that obviously Mr. Ewan Rankin, who
Hello, mate.
Has got a certain package.
Later. iPad here, ready for the Mac show. Geez. Unopened. See, I've got restraint and self-control, unlike those Gazmas. Pathetic. The other thing, mate, is I've worked out you're not going to get yours until 5 o'clock.
Go on, then.
Do you know why? Because I've done work for logistics firms, and the principle of logistics is apparently you drive out to the furthest point away from the depot and you work your way back to the depot, because if you went out, when you came back, you'd never get back because all the traffic would be bad. So there you go.
So that means I won't be getting mine until 3.
Well, if you're living Skokie, yeah, but I mean...
Well, I live near Skokie.
I could walk two miles down the road and get one now.
You could go to PC World and get one now.
Yeah, I could walk down the road and have one before the Mac show.
Mind you, the PC World in Enfield.
No, I wouldn't go to Enfield. I'm not that brave.
And rounding out our little panel, is that's Mr. Alex Fox. How are you doing, Alex?
Better than you. I haven't got an iPad either, but I didn't want one.
Yeah, that's why you haven't got one.
We're here.
Anyway, shall we do some news?
The photo show. Here we go.
Sure, yeah.
Take one.
Okay, so Sony unleashes or reveals its Alpha 57 camera, supposedly to replace the Alpha 55. This camera apparently does 12 frames per second shooting, continuous autofocus, max ISO of 16,000, and uses an APS-C size 16.1 megapixel sensor. It's also got something called SLT, single lens translucent. Now, before I ask you guys about the camera, what the hell is SLT?
Well, this has actually been around for a while, but the mirror, your reflex mirror, is fixed, and it's semi-translucent. So some light goes through the mirror to the film, or in this case, a digital sensor, and some light gets directed up towards the viewfinder. I used to have one of these cameras for a brief while. I want to say maybe it was a Canon from like the 60s. It had the same exact concept where the mirror was fixed. It didn't, move up and down with every shot.
Okay, so it's not the full, all the light coming through the lens, is not all of it falling onto the sensor then, is that?
Right.
Well, there's been prismatic effects used around the lens and the shutter for a long period of time, as Chris says. You know, you had a physical prism that would send some light through and some light up. It would partial reflected, partial pass through.
Okay. Which does strike you as a bit odd because of all the camera manufacturers, especially say Fuji last week when we looked at some of the stuff they were doing. They're basically trying to get every last ion, if that's the right word, of light to hit that sensor as, you know, unadulterated as it possibly can be. And to go this way, it sort of says, oh, well, we'll send some light up there, some light to the left, some light to the right, and we'll just see what we get at the end of the day. So, I mean, that might be why. I mean, to Chris's ears, it probably sounds like wonderful, but it's got a resolution of 8.4 megapixels only. And that might be because you've got to have such great big pixels to get the amount of light you need to not suffer too badly because you're not actually getting the full gamut of light through in the first place.
That's a great point, yeah.
Actually, that's only 8.4 when you're shooting 12 frames a second. Normally, it's 16.1.
Yeah.
Who'd want 16.1? But yeah, so, I mean, but the point is, they've obviously had to limit the actual amount of pixelage to compensate for the lesser available light coming through. It just seems like a really, really odd thing to do because it's going against everything everybody else is trying to do. But, you know, maybe that's innovation. That's how you get somewhere, by going against everyone else. I don't know.
Well, I mean, there are a couple benefits. I mean, when your mirror isn't moving with each shot, you get a much quieter shutter. And you can also do faster frame rate. You can do these fast frame rates for basically without having a lot of complicated mechanical stuff to deal with the mirror flipping up and down back and forth so fast. Like, you know, like the Canons and Nikons that do these fast frame rates, they have these, you know, all these counterbalances and like shock absorbing mechanisms and everything to keep that mirror from messing up.
No, I appreciate your point. But if you were going, if you look at an evolution from mirrored camera to mirrorless camera, I'd have said maybe this is the middle. This is where it should have gone between one and the other, a translucent mirror. But to have mirrorless, why the hell would you want to go back to having a translucent mirror? If you've already got the technology that does away with the mirror having to flick up and down and even give you more light through the lens to the sensor, what the hell do you want to go backwards for?
Well, again, you know, if you still like having an eye-level finder, this is a compromise.
I think the problem with this is a little bit of what Alex is saying there is that this is kind of almost retrograde technology in the fact that, A, it's an old idea anyway. Prismatic stuff has been around for a long period of time. If it was that good, it would have taken hold when it had the opportunity. If you're talking about the fact that you do like doing things like hooking up your camera to your telescope and that kind of thing, this is going to be brilliant, absolutely fantastic, apart from the fact that there's probably two dozen other mirrorless systems out there that are going to be there or in the next year and a half will be there that will do the job significantly better. If you're going to spend money, I wouldn't spend it on this. There's nothing that appeals about this camera over and above everything else, and they're trying to use a technology which isn't better to try and sell it, and it's not going to. Plainly isn't going to. And the Alpha, I shot with the Alpha 55, someone else's, for half a day, and it was nasty.
The only plus, again, I can think of is because of you're using a mirrored camera, even though it's a through mirror, you are able to use exactly the same lenses as you had before. Whereas if you're using a mirrorless camera, then you've got all the crop factors and all the rest of it. Maybe this is their, like Chris used the word, maybe this is their compromise, so you can still use their old lenses on their slightly newer camera. Maybe that's the only positive I can think of.
Sony also used this announcement to say that they are not pulling out of the DSLR category when they unveiled this camera, which I think you speculated about the other week, Alex.
Yeah, I did, and I'm really glad to see they're not, because of Sony, probably, of all the manufacturers, you've got Canon and Nikon, who basically ignore everyone else. They just fight amongst themselves. Sony have been the ones that have been coming along in the background, and Sony were the first to give a really good, high-quality, high-megapixel sensor other than Canon. They were way ahead of Nikon. Sony had 21 megapixels at an affordable price way before. I mean, Canon had it on the 1DS Mark II, I think it was 18 or something. And then Sony came out with their version. I think it was an 800 or a 900. I can't remember what it was. And that was a similar size, if not a slightly higher resolution. But it wasn't the ludicrous prices. And I think they come into the market that I think the reason why you've got sort of 30 plus megapixel Nikons and things is because of Sony, not because of Canon. So I think it's really important because Sony keeps the others honest.
Well, another interesting thing is that, I mean, a lot of specs on this camera are pretty good, you know, as far as like the autofocusing system and things like that. On, you know, at least on paper, it's delivering a lot of, you know, fairly high-end stuff, but I think it's like $800 US for a kit with a kit lens. I mean, that's it's a good price.
Very good.
You know, if I were looking at something in this price range, you know, I'd definitely look at it. I'd consider it. And you know, you've got the basically Sony bought Minolta, so you've got the Minolta engineering, you've got Sony's engineering, and then you've got Carl Zeiss doing lens design. I mean, it's a pretty good combination, you know, and it I hesitate to say like it's garbage just because, you know, it seems like the semi-translucent mirror isn't you know delivering like the light capacity we think it should, but at least on paper it looks good, and I would give it a consideration if I were in that budget.
This is the case of having your eye on the wrong ball, though. I mean, if you look at all the big three that are currently out of the market, Pentax, Canon, Nikon, they're all watching the CSC market very, very closely at the moment. They're, will they, won't they jump in? And if they jump in, that's going to be really interesting as to what happens with lens compatibility and all that kind of stuff. I really can't see Canon and Nikon embracing Micro Four Thirds to that kind of degree and so on. And Sony have just—they've stuck to large volume, you know, standard 35mm DSLR type body, and that's not the market that seems to be emerging at the moment. I mean, Canon and Nikon have done it, but they've got an established presence there with lenses to fit that people have invested in. This thing hasn't. This thing hasn't got that bulk market. It hasn't got the kind of what's the word I'm looking for? The fanboy, if you like, behind it.
It's just a base, isn't it? They haven't got a base to build from.
No, there's nothing to come from it. So they've come out with a technology which doesn't appear to be at cutting edge, that they're trying to sell as cutting edge, and it's not. They've come out with other things. I mean, they're talking about the video doing AVC CHD. I'm no expert here, but in my mind, I've had an AVC HD camera, and it was a pain in the arse trying to get the files out of it. You had to import some of the systems that you've got didn't import AVC HD. You couldn't have, there wasn't a file that you could get from like a file structure to drag across onto your desktop. There was times I sat and you ended up having to buy software that specifically did AVC HD to get it out. You know, it should be shooting an MPEG 4. It should be shooting an MPEG 2. It shouldn't be doing bloody AVC HD. It's crap.
Yeah, Sony do like the proprietary files.
Remember the memory stick.
You're going to part with $800 here, and in a year's time, having taken pictures and gone down the pub and said to your mates, "What a great camera it is! You ought to buy one." And they've bought one as well. You're going to realize what a piece of crap you've got.
Well, my stepdad just bought a Sony a little while ago, and he's coming on the next photo shoot, and I'm sure he's going to come and ask you guys for some tips. So
let him go to Ewan.
I'll be sure to bring the location of the nearest Jessops with me then.
Oh dear. Okay. Sorry, John. moving on. So apparently the Olympics are coming up this summer, as maybe you've heard, and Nikon apparently are going to use robot mounted D4s to capture some of the imagery going on. You think this is going to be an interesting trend and possible future other sporting events?
Well, what I like about it, they're doing a robot mounted camera, and that sounds really, really cool, and I want one, but that's because of the robot more than the camera. But what I like what they're doing is I don't know if they're some official sponsor or something, they probably are, but they're sort of setting up a whole network of you know, camera repair shops, camera swap outs, camera loans, camera this, that and the other. So basically, if you've got anywhere near a high-end Nikon, there's going to be loads and loads of people around to clean your camera, fix your camera, do this for you, do that for you. You need a lens, there's going to be a Sony man around the corner to give you one. A lens, that is. And, it didn't go down too well. And I just think it's a really, really good idea. Take a really major event and absolutely bombard it with your technology to the extent that anybody that turns up at the Olympics without a camera or a decision on what camera you want to buy, you're going to walk out saying it's got to be a Nikon. Because I saw one in that robot, and there's about 100,000 Nikon people running around telling me, oh, you can borrow that lens, or I'll lend you a camera. I think it's a brilliant publicity idea, if nothing else.
Canon does something similar, like at major sports events and races, they basically pull up a mobile trailer where you can go and rent lenses and borrow stuff, or if your equipment fails or something. I've seen that at like the Indy 500 before. In the F1 races at Indianapolis.
I want to know what a robot is. Because it's just, I've got this vision in my head of like a Nikon coming down on little, like a little gyrocopter that's floating next to your face and going, danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Will Robinson.
there's been remote cameras that have been remotely triggered at sporting events for Christ knows how long. I mean,
yeah, but they've not called them robots before.
Exactly. You know, you go and buy one of those little low-level three-way tripod things that are used for display, and you take it to your camera event, and you put a little remote trigger on top that activates 100 meters away, and you wait till the photographer swing, and you fire it, and you get those wonderful fisheye type stuff of them at impact. It's been done for ages. Now, if you're talking about this thing's going to get shoved into a glass bowl that's propelled and flies through the water following the swimmers and stuff, it seems like a really big control when actually most people don't want a still image like that. They probably want a moving image. And most of the moving images that are going to be shot, they could take decent stills off them, at least to publicise with. And you could do that with a tethered system with just a camera that's built for the purpose. I'm a bit lost to see. I want to know what a robot is, because the robot's just a throwaway line. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, but that's why we're talking about it.
Exactly. You got the Honda thing walking around, you know, and behind its visor, it's got a D4. Big deal.
Well, that would be really cool. You have a Honda robot holding a D4, right? And then going, come on, say cheese, and doing all that sort of business. Now, that really would be cool.
I want to see a D4 dance.
There you go.
I want to see a Nikonator.
I'll be back.
I'll be back to show.
But at the end of this, I really like the one line I'm really proud of, even though it's got nothing to do with me. It says, meanwhile, Nikon claims the orders for the D800 are unprecedented. And so they should be.
I want to point out as well, the chat room's saying I'm talking out my arse on AVCHD, which is not uncommon. I did say before I started, I didn't know what I was saying particularly, but my experience of AVCHD was it was a piece of crap. And Carl, you were nodding maniacally when I was saying it, so...
Yeah, in the past...
the blame.
Yeah, AVCHD, it wasn't friendly.
In the past, when I had a Sony camcorder, and I'll try and import into, what was it? I think it was Premiere back then I was using. It was hell to get it off the camera. I know later on they introduced various drivers and stuff, codecs, whatever, and it was a lot easier. But when I started out, it was a nightmare. And it's always Sony. Sony always do their proprietary stuff. They look at what everyone else is doing and think, oh, no, we'll do something else. And that's always bugged me about Sony.
I mean, video has got to go down the same kind of route as photography. It's got to find a standard format that people like and they'll embrace it, and it's functional, it's used, rather than the conversion. Just, you know, the more you convert, the worse it looks.
Well, what you want to do is just devise something and call it JPEG video, and every bugger will understand it then, and that'll be the end of it.
They have that. It's called Motion JPEG.
Yeah, but no, you call it JPEG video. No, it's got to be called what I say, not what you say. Not MP4, MP4.26, H.264, blah, blah, blah. That's all you need, something really simple so people like me can understand. I would rather I want movie JPEG or movie RAW. That's it. And then me and you can fight about it for the rest of our lives.
RAW versus JPEG in movie format, just what this world needs.
Have you heard about this? This guy's making a digital Bullex.
A digital what? Big say again. Have I got another bleep this week? No?
A digital Bullex. You know, Bullex 16mm camera.
Right.
Oh, I thought you said that.
And it shoots in RAW video.
There you go.
Huge.
Sony, or not Sony, Adobe actually has a standardized format, Cinema RAW or Cinema DNG or something like that, something to that effect.
Mm. And I was camera. In Amsterdam once, and I saw a cinema that said something like Cinema RAW, but I'm not sure that's the same thing.
Yeah, because I know, I mean, you know, Red and Ariflex and all those cameras, they have their own proprietary RAW formats that have to be converted.
Well, it was a nightmare. Back in the past, it was a nightmare. Like you say, the chat room saying it's not so big a deal anymore, but the fact that there's still another video file system out there is a pain, I think.
A-Track 3, anyone?
Can I just ask
a question? Because I don't know much about video. Right, but you know in the old days where you had a really good, I don't know, was it 70 mil film or something like that? I don't want to get in any arguments about raw video, but is, other than AVI, I think it is, are there any video digital formats that are recorded which are lossless, which are non-compressed at source? So would a raw video, for want of a better word, be a really good thing for, I mean, maybe not everyday videoing, but would that be the closest you'd get to 70 mil film? Because I don't know very much about it. I was just actually asking.
Yeah, that's basically like a 4K camera, like a Red or an Arriflex.
Well, even that wouldn't be there. It's still,
but it'd still be compressed at some rate. No, I just wondered if there was such a thing, but there is, but not for the likes of me.
Yeah, consumer cameras all do compressed. All the digital video cameras do compressed.
Okay. File sizes would be huge. Moving on, looks like Samsung have been listening to Ewan, and they're considering Android-based digital cameras in the future, possibly.
Maybe.
I doubt they've been listening to me.
You never know. Don't put yourself down.
I can't get the cat to listen to me.
So again, this is one more manufacturer who's like going down the connected world, shall we say. And I still think everyone else should be doing. I don't understand why the new DSLs like from Canon, Nikon come out and they haven't just simply got a Wi-Fi aerial in them or something like that. Something, because it seems so archaic to have to take the card out, plug it into something else.
Well, then they couldn't sell you that wireless adapter. I mean, come on.
Well, Bates has added a couple hundred quid to the base price of the camera, surely. What I was getting at is, where do you think cameras will be in 5 years' time? Surely they've got to embrace this technology at some point.
They'll all be in the same cupboard in my spare room.
It's because you're a hoarder.
Along with the ones that have been there for 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's this, I see that we have a related article from DP Review where it says that Samsung is considering carrier subsidized connected cameras. So in a sense, like you get a subsidized phone, you can get a camera with built in like 3G or 4G, and you buy it at a discount and you buy a contract to always have it connected, and then you, wherever you are, you can take pictures and it goes to your Flickr or your Instagram or whatever automatically. And I think this is something Ewan has sort of had this basic idea that, you know, cameras should have this connected, always-on connection like our smartphones do. And the reason why smartphones are so popular as cameras is that connection that's always there. So it looks like someone's at least admitting they're thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering when we'll see it on the more professional, higher-end cameras, that's all.
You're going to have file size as an issue then, though, and also you're going to have an issue with the fact that when you get to that more high-end stuff, a lot of people want to do more with it post-production, levels correction, that kind of stuff. I think the always-on data thing, I never saw hitting the DSLR market. I always saw always-on data being about the party camera, the handbag camera that was all about, I go out, I go on holiday, and I've got an album waiting for me when I get back to the hotel in Flickr, and it makes an automatic set or collection or something like that. My family can view it, I can authorize people to view it, it's Instagram, you know, that kind of thing is always where I've seen it, the requirement for it with an always-on data connection.
I slightly disagree and agree. The reason, what I'm saying is, I would like a decent DSLR that had that functionality, which would allow me to do all those things you want, make an instant iCloud or whatever album for me, with the low quality JPEGs. Because one of the frustrations I find is if I do use a DSLR to do something important, it doesn't mean I don't want the functionality of the small stuff for the everyday use, but I don't want to use an iPhone to take a picture that I want to go straight back onto Flickr, because when I get home, I want to do something clever with it. I want a large file. I want to print a poster. But if you have that ability to take the small JPEG file that your camera makes at the same time anyway and instantly upload it, so it's part of the, it's the same image, just a smaller resolution quick flick down to Flickr version of it at the same time, you've got the best of both worlds. So you can have your reference thing going straight up to Flickr for your family album, and then you can have your decent picture to play with at home, play with in your office, and do everything else. I don't think it's a one or the other. I think you should definitely be able to do both, because I can see a really good reason for using both.
I mean, I can see the always-on thing for the smaller cameras, but I'm talking about when you bring your pro camera home and it's on your own network, your own Wi-Fi network. I don't see why I can't take advantage of it then, for example. And I'm, you know, 5 years from now, I'm thinking we will have faster network connection. Well, I hope so. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, chat room's going on about 4G and stuff like that, but the one thing that I've realised in the last sort of 3 or 4 months is that I think you're always going to get about 1/4 of the advertised speed of any of the systems that you purchase, and you've got to live with it. You know, you get 47 megabits a second advertised for 4G. You'll probably get no more than 10 at best throughout most of your path using 4G until we get 5G, 6G, whatever the next generation is. And then you'll get 1/4 of that, because I'm getting 1/4 HSPA. You're getting 1/4 HSPA plus. I got 1/4 3G. I'm going to get 1/4 4G. It's.
Yeah. So, I mean, always on trickle feed, if you like, of a low resolution JPEG, I don't think is an issue, because there's no, you don't need it instantly on Flickr. You just need it to get there. So by the time you get home, it's trickle fed all the way along in your car or wherever you are, and it will be there for you. It will be all flickered up. But I mean, the point is, if you want to take a decent picture with a decent camera, then you don't have that option until you come home, process it, and do all your messing around, and then make a low quality one to stick on Flickr. Mm. The camera can do that automatically, and it can buzz up your low quality reference shot instantly, the same as any other camera. I really do believe it would be a bonus to me. It'd be a bonus to your customer. Say I'm out doing a shoot for a customer, the fact that they can see an instant or near instant photo gallery of what I've just shot on their behalf, and they can be on the phone saying, oh, I like number two. Can you just go around and do it at a slightly different angle for me? I can see that being incredibly useful, because then I've got the high resolution stuff to give them the full size, full quality print or whatever they want afterwards. I can see a really good use case for myself with, you know, what you were talking about, DSLRs being able to do a similar thing. No one's convinced.
I'm not.
I think it's a good idea.
It's a great idea, but I don't think you won't get leverage as a workflow amongst many people. I wouldn't use it in that way.
Huh. Okay.
Moving on, looks like someone got in trouble for taking the photograph in the wrong place again. Transport chiefs blasted this week over a London bus photo ban. Apparently someone took a photo on a bus and then was told, you're not allowed to do that, as usual, what happens in London. Apparently we're running out of places we can take photographs.
What is it with you Brits?
You're going to find out when you guys come over for the Olympics, I tell you.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to take a picture of anything.
You have to draw everything.
But if you draw too quickly, they'll confiscate it.
I mean, in the end, it turns out that this was the person who actually gave this information was talking complete bunkum, and her superior said, no, that's not the case. You can do whatever you want. As long as you're not doing it for prolonged periods, you can take a snap wherever you want. But again, it just seems to me that someone ill-informed is passing laws on passers-by.
Yeah, I mean, Miranda Crabtree is the lady in question, who no longer works for TfL, but wasn't dismissed or anything because of this thing, what it said. But the guy that clarified it said that there was a quick snap is perfectly acceptable. So that means he's clearly saying that there's some photography which they would deem to be unacceptable.
Right.
You know, if I sat at the back of a bus and started taking candids of people, you know, looking out the window, old guy by the door, that kind of stuff, that clearly is not acceptable to them, because, I mean, public transport, is that, I'm not sure that's a public place. Certainly they're saying that bus stops are theirs. Well, you don't own the land that a bus stops on. You own the bus stop, but it's on pavement, and I'm not sure you own the pavement. I think that's still public highway. We'd have to check that one out. I don't think they can.
I think the majority of their issues with the you can take a quick picture and not take a slow setup picture is I think it's more to do with espionage, and I'm not necessarily talking about terrorist espionage. I'm talking about, you know, we make our buses in a certain way, or we do this and that and another way. And, you know, I think a lot of it's to do with, you know, a lot of companies are quite happy for you to use a point and shoot. Stop laughing at me. A lot of companies are happy for you to use a point and shoot and take an overall shot of something, but they don't necessarily want you to, you know, be able to make a schematic of every nut and bolt that's gone together to build something.
The bus espionage market is enormous, mate. You're absolutely right. I can't see why I never saw it before.
Generally, actually, than the bus people. But, you know, a lot of these shops that have spent hundreds of, like, take an Apple shop, for instance. They spend millions and millions and millions on design, and everything is intricate to the last millimeter. They probably wouldn't go mad if you walked in and took a quick snapshot with your iPhone. But if you sat there with a tripod and you started, you know, making sure that you got every last detail to scale and everything of something they've spent millions of pounds designing, so you can then go down the road and get your own one made, I think they've probably got a right to say, you know, that's not the same thing as taking a quick shot.
I can't believe you're trying to save the bus espionage comment. I
don't disagree with what you're saying exactly, but I'm just trying to imagine someone trying to clandestinely take pictures, walking in with a tripod and setting it up and be very deliberate about the shots. I mean, it seems to me like someone who is trying to clandestinely capture pictures would just make it look like they're taking snapshots.
I mean, yeah, but the point is, a snapshot is fairly useless for.
Or they'd have a camera in their shoe.
Don't give them ideas.
Or their lighter. Or they'd have a fake cigarette.
Oh, can someone in the chat room come up with something to back up my theory?
I'm going to do it, Alex.
Listen, bus espionage is a serious business, my friend, and is not to be laughed at.
I'm going to take my camera down. I'm going to shoot the local bus stop, and I'm going to erect an exact duplicate in my garden. There you go.
Well, you say that, actually, but our rugby club, the dugouts, if you like, for the teams are stolen bus shelters. No, they're not stolen. We purchased them, but...
Okay. Reclaimed. Is that what they call it?
Now, whether we actually own them or not, whether they're still owned by West Midlands Transport, I'm not sure. But we have had some people sneaking around taking photographs. Now, I thought that they were taking photographs of the rugby, but they could have been taking photographs of the bus shelters. I hadn't thought of that until today.
Yeah.
Alex makes a very valid point there.
Come up with a joke about buses and shelters. I'm just not quick enough.
Alex is not coming back on the show, is he? Look, he's not happy. I'm sorry, mate.
Moving on.
Nah, I'll be all right. I'll get you next. Don't worry.
Bus espionage. Title sorted.
Or the
busted.
God. Sorry. So all the guys out there still using film, 35mm film, can now relax, because apparently there is a way of making your 35mm film look exactly like you've just pressed the button on Instagram.
Yay!
You can now distress your film by putting it through a dishwasher cycle, apparently. All you simply do is put a roll of film through a dishwasher wash cycle, let it sit around for a few days, pull it out of the can in a dark room, dry it carefully using a hairdryer, roll the film back into the can, shoot and process the film like you would normally. Or point your iPhone at something and just use Instagram.
Everything there is the reason I hate film. I never particularly liked it when I had to use it, and I hate it even more now. And why on earth would you do that?
But it looks exactly like Instagram, and you've done it on real film.
I mean, you know,
in the dark room, though. I mean,
I could do it in a Lightroom on a screen. The point is, I mean, Alex, I get. I mean, Alex does something that's extremely specific, and the fine detail that he gets out of film, I really get that. I just cannot understand why the average shooter would buy film anymore. And they're going about, the colours. Oh, stuff the colours. It's rubbish. Absolute bunkum. It's just, film was always a pain in the arse, and it's still a pain in the arse.
You sound like a grubby old man.
I am. I've had enough of this film. Forget Raw versus JPEG. I'm into film versus digital now. There we go. I'm going to crush film.
Let's do it.
I don't think you're going to have much trouble. I think Kodak can do it for you.
Yeah.
No, I mean, he used to do stuff, and it used to take you weeks to do it, and now it takes you 10 minutes. I don't want to go back. What gets me as well is that they've spent so long, you know, you're going to spend how long? A wash cycle's 2 hours. You're going to leave it sit around for a few more days. You're going to take it in and carefully dry it with a hairdryer before winding it back onto the sprockets in the film canister before you then take out and shoot a crap picture with it.
Couldn't just put it in the Hulk in the first place.
All my pictures look that distressed anyway.
The two examples that they've got, I can't say that word. They're utter toot.
Rubbish.
Rubbish. They're not even nice pictures.
I'll have you know, and I've got to be really careful because they're really rich and powerful people. I know a number of people that buy prints that don't look even as good as that because of they think it's arty, right? I'm not saying any more, right? Because of I better not slag off the entire art world because it might not do me much financial good. But there are people out there that buy things that make this look really good because of they think someone else has told them that it's really good because it's artistic. I'm not saying any more than that.
Chat room, a super chicken in the chat room has got the word that I intended to say and he agrees with me. Missy says...
He spelt it wrong, he's put an E on the end.
Yeah, I know. Missy said, film separated the boys from the men. No, it separated perfectly good photographers from their wallets, nothing more. And Alex is a testament to the fact that it's separating him even further from his wallet.
Oh, God, forget it.
15% this week, 20% the next.
There you go. Missy also says, I think it's art when you take a new photo and make it look old, which is exactly what Instagram does.
Yeah.
Well, you can always wait 50 years.
You can make a fortune on Instagram in the artwork. It sounds art world, it sounds like, then.
But it was, this is the thing. You look at Analog App. I don't rate Analog App. I think it was utter toot. But I took all the filters and I've used the filters myself because I've taken everything out of the. I've unzipped the package that the application came with, and I took all the filters out of it and I've used them myself. But I've used them better because I'm not doing the compression crap that they're doing.
You keep unzipping your package to yourself, young man.
Okay. Well, I thought this podcast was getting good.
Sorry about that. Moving on. So we've got another new segment this week, which we're going to alternate with the other new segment. You see what I mean?
I'm sorry, I just read what Missy put in the chat room. Oh, you really do need to explain to her about the difference in language.
Yeah, I think we will have to have a chat about that. Anyway, so this is how would you save the day? Okay, well, I'm going to present a scenario and something's going to happen, and you guys would like tell us how you'd save the situation. So the first one, this was presented by Steve, by the way. You've been booked for a wedding shoot. The bride looks lovely. The groom looks handsome and sober, which is probably a good thing. The church grounds or park or whatever the location is looks great. You've worked out all your best shots, where they will be taken, what poses you will be giving them in directions. And when all of a sudden, as in Britain, most of the time, the heavens open, massive downpour that looks... doesn't look like letting up. Sorry, I couldn't read my own writing there. What would you do to save the day in this situation? Anyone can jump in and give their points.
I set my ISO to 1600 for shooting indoors.
Okay.
I'd wait for the perfect lightning strike and I'd set mine to 50. Yeah.
Squeaky toy. Yeah. Essential. Yes. Squeaky toy.
Squeaky toy.
Yeah, that's right. I'd get all the children.
If you're doing it outside a church, normally churches want you to move on because they've got to get the next guys in. So what would you suggest?
Well, normally, I mean, look, we're talking about Great British churches. Most of the time in Great British churches, you do have quite a large porch. The one thing you're going to know as a wedding photographer, and this is one of the reasons I can't stand doing it, if it's going to rain, you're going to be the bugger that gets wet, okay? Because of no matter where they want themselves to stand, you're the one that's going to be soaking wet standing trying to get the picture. You've got to know that. So I would stick them in a porchway. You see, as long as they're near the front of the porchway in the church, for instance, you're still going to get quite a lot of light on them. Use the porchway. Use it to frame the picture. You've got to get slightly more artistic. And yes, you might have to go to 1600. But other than that, I would use going indoors as a very last resort, and just make sure you've got an assistant with a big umbrella.
Yeah, I mean, here in the States, I have done a lot of weddings, and like Alex, I don't particularly like doing them, but it's money, so I do it. But, I mean, primarily, like, I would say anywhere from 75 to 85% of, like, the posed shots are done inside the church anyway. So, I mean, we always have portable monolights with us in a battery pack, and we can just set them up anywhere inside the church. So that's never been an issue. You know, if, I would say that, again, the number of outdoor weddings I've done are few and far between because there's so many issues. Last year I shot a wedding in July, and it was the hottest day of the year, and it was so humid, and the mosquitoes were everywhere, and it was just almost impossible to get pictures because we're trying to set up and make sure no one's getting, like, blasted by the sun and making faces. At the same time, everybody's getting eaten by mosquitoes, so they're all annoyed, and they're all, you know, some of the guys were a little overweight, and we were all sweating, and the girls didn't want to mess up their dresses, and it was just a nightmare. But, I think it just comes down to, if you're a wedding photographer, you know, the whole day is going to be a pain in the ass. The bride's going to be in a bad mood. The bride's mother is going to be
in a worse mood. Yeah.
The worst mood. Yeah. I mean, the groomsmen are all going to be getting drunk and not paying attention to what's happening. It's just a difficult situation as it is anyway. So, I mean, a little bit of rain, whatever. I mean, it's like not catastrophic, I think, from my experience.
I mean, you can always use the rain as an artistic effect. You know, there's nothing wrong with having the bride and groom. I mean, obviously, they're not going to be for your standard shots, but there's nothing wrong with your bride and groom holding two really large umbrellas in front of them, laughing with the rain coming off them. It makes an interesting shot. You know, in a funny way, it will give them something that a normal photo album doesn't have. So you can still try and figure out all your standard shots, but it's going to give you another shot. I bet you the picture with the rain falling off the umbrellas with those two having their first kiss outside in the pouring rain or something, I bet you that would be one that definitely goes into the album. So you could actually use it for, you know, the effect that it gives you.
There's nothing to save. I mean, whether you save the day or not has got nothing to do with you, because it's to do with the mentality of the people whose picture that you're taking. And one of the things that I've done in the past is say to them, do bear in mind, this is a memento of your day. And if it pisses down with rain, that's still the day. It's, again, photography is about capturing the moment. We've gone on about it no end on this show. And it is about capturing the moment. If that's what the moment is, live with it. If you've got some princess bride who is probably going to divorce in 2 years because of the fact all she wanted was to stick, you know, she's had a pillowcase on her head since she was 3 years old, then there's nothing you're going to do to save the day because she's going to be a frigging nightmare the minute that one of the choir boys trips over. You know, it's on the video. There is no saving that.
As I read somewhere yesterday, beware the brides of March.
Oh.
There you go.
Okay.
Sorry.
Sorry, just to add, I think people hire Ewan for weddings because he's so positive.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, that joke wasn't mine. That was Missy's joke, so I got to come clean on that one. Sorry. Moving on to questions. Hi, Carl. I'm loving the show. I have a question for you and the guests. I finally switched over to using RAW, and I want to know if there's a difference between iPhoto 11 and Photoshop Elements 9 for importing my images. Does one give better results, or do they import files in much the same way? Keep up the great work, Tim.
I can say that iPhoto is always going to do a default RAW processing based on your camera settings. So, you know, like when you pull, like if you pull a RAW image into Photoshop, it first starts by reading off the camera settings and adjusting the RAW conversion, so it would look essentially like if you'd shot a JPEG in camera, and then you can start tweaking the knobs. iPhoto, I don't think has any kind of adjustments you can do to the RAW conversion. It just imports it using the camera settings, the camera default settings. Photoshop Elements 9, I'm not sure. I know it uses the same RAW conversion engine that regular Photoshop does, but I don't know how much tweaking it has, so I'm not as familiar. Maybe one of you guys have a better idea about that.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say is with iPhoto, although it will take RAW, you may as well shoot it in JPEG because of for all the difference it makes in iPhoto. I mean, that'll be music to you and ears, but for all the difference it makes in iPhoto, it's probably not worth your while. Photoshop, I think you can do RAW adjustments in Photoshop Elements, but again, I'll go back to the free RAW converter software that you can get free from Adobe. So if you are going to shoot in RAW, there's no reason why you can't convert your RAW files first in a separate RAW file converter, if that's what you want to do, and then send them to anything you want, iPhoto or Photo Elements or anything. There is that option of having full control, and it's free, and you can download it from Adobe anytime you want. So that's another option anyway.
I'd also consider Aperture or Lightroom in this situation, because those are built from the ground up for handling RAW images and then doing the sort of organizing stuff that iPhoto does. So if that's the kind of tool you're looking for, that's great. And then it's, both of those are kind of built to kind of round trip your images into Photoshop or something else for extra editing if you do need more.
Anything to add, Ewan?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding of this, you're never actually looking at a RAW image anyway. What you're looking at is a representation of what the RAW data is suggesting it will look like. And at best, you're only ever seeing effectively a TIFF in Photoshop. You know, what you see on the screen is a TIFF. It's not a RAW image per se. RAW is data, so you're not actually, there isn't a RAW image to look at. So it's always been converted or moved or changed in some way for the fact that you can actually see it. What the processing does is it gives you that ability to change the conversion process to the visual image. So if you look at Adobe Bridge, what you're doing is moving sliders around to change the conversion process of what you see in front of you. But what you see in front of you isn't RAW; it's the converted image. So everything converts it before you start.
Image, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You never see the RAW image. There is no RAW image. There's RAW versus JPEG is, JPEG is a thing that you see. It's pixels. It's dots. Whereas JPEG, RAW isn't. RAW is pure data, plain and simple. And it's the conversion tool that you're manipulating. That's all.
Okay. Just on the side, does the Photoshop Elements do the filing system like Photoshop iPhoto does as well?
No.
I've not used it, you see.
Elements is Photoshop cheapy. It's two versions back, maybe three versions back.
Okay. Do you get a version of Bridge with Blow with Elements?
I don't think so.
No, it gives you a conversion front end that you look at for RAW, but it doesn't give you a Bridge, not in the same way, no.
Okay.
Okay, next question. Hi, guys. Hi, Carl and the guys. So I've been thinking about getting a monopod for a while, but can't decide if it's worth the money or not. What would I be using it for exactly over my tripod, and would I just get the monopod, or should I buy a ball head mount for the top as well? Thanks, Brian of Glasgow.
I would say watch for a ball head, because there's ball heads and there's ball heads. And there's ball heads that will mean that your lens will flop forwards, and that you tighten them and tighten them and tighten them, and then every day you tighten it that little bit more until eventually you just can't tighten it anymore, and the head's lolloping around like it's not even bothered to be connected. It depends on the size of the lens that you've got. But a ball head's useful, but I think what you're looking for with a monopod is more the ability to move quickly and then get static. And a ball head from that is just another adjustment that kind of defeats the purpose. I mean, you look at a monopod gives you two stops, fellas, you reckon?
Oh, I don't think it gives you that.
It'll give you two stops benefit at most.
Yeah, I wouldn't have said that, but yeah.
And that's it. So it's about flexibility and movement and getting a little bit more stability before you shoot the thing that's moving. But you wouldn't go out bird watching with a monopod.
I mean, one of the things with a monopod I always find is I don't use it in the same way as a tripod. I use it more as in, I find if I've got a monopod in front of me, for instance, a good example, our friend on the photo walk, Aaron, he used my monopod with his Canon and your enormous, I don't know what it was, 500mm or 400mm lens. Now, he wanted to set a picture. It wasn't so much the speed that was the issue with him. He could have held it and got the similar picture, but you can't get the nuances if you're struggling carrying a heavy camera and you're trying to get at funny angles and you're trying to tilt it in a certain way. When you've got a monopod, it won't hold it rock steady like you do with a tripod, but what it will do it takes the weight for you. So you've got freedom of movement. You've got freedom of nuances. And then you'll still have to set it at, you know, 60th of a second or something. It doesn't. You're not going to get away with setting it at 2 seconds and it's not going to move as you could with a tripod. But what it's really for is literally just to take the weight of the camera. So whether it gives you extra stops or not, I'm not sure. It might give you a half a stop or one stop if you're lucky. But what it does, it takes the weight and it takes the pressure off your arms, and it helps you with setup a lot easier. That's how I find it useful.
Yeah, I think probably the two most common use cases for a monopod are sports photography. So essentially, like, you know, if you're shooting football and the players are moving up and down the field, you can grab that monopod and your camera, quickly, you know, move down to where the action is or the next, you know, whatever's going on, set the monopod, you know, down on the ground, and you get a little bit of steadying than you would just hand holding, but it's really more for, like you said, taking the weight off a big heavy lens, you know, ease of movement. I think the other scenario that people use monopods a lot are like kind of like nature photography when they hike.
That's what I use mine for. It's a walking stick.
Oh, yeah.
Same here.
Yeah, but the problem you've got, you say with the weight of the lens, but the problem you've got with the weight of the lens is the vertical movement up and down. What a monopod will do is give you the ability to just control the lateral movement.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're doing panning.
And if you've got one directional movement that's disappeared, you're going to naturally be able to shoot in slightly more adverse circumstances than you would do if you've got free hands movement all over the place. You know, you talk about these super zooms that we've got. You super zoom up to, you know, 1200 millimeters. You stick one of those on a monopod, you'll get a lot better than if you try and shoot freehand with it at 1200.
No, granted. And going back to what you said,
that's the stability element.
Yeah. But to go back to what you said about a ball head, I had somewhere a ball head that probably cost £500 or £600. And I did put heavy cameras on it, but I never get more than a year out of them. You know, they aren't a very, they're really not a long term. I mean, the monopod that I use, the same one that Carl uses, it has enough movements within the head, the way it works. There's enough movements within it. Of course, you don't need a swivel on a monopod because you can ease. It's not like a tripod where you have to move three legs around. It's very, very easy to get the lateral turning. That's not an issue. And so what this does, it gives you a screw top which will go the vertical. It will give you that. So you don't really need a ball head. It's an expensive toy which won't work for very long.
Mm. Plus, this monopod, it was cheap, wasn't it? It was £15, I think, Alex.
No, it was less than that, £10, I think.
Yeah, 15. Exactly. £15 now after you guys made them popular.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, if you use a modular system like Manfrotto or something like that, you can get a ball head or whatever head you like, and you can swap it between your tripod and your monopod. You know, and a monopod base in and of itself is usually, I mean, it's relatively inexpensive in my experience.
Yeah, I mean, you can pay £100 for one, but I don't know why you'd want to.
So definitely worth it, Will's saying.
Oh, yeah.
I'd say so.
Now, next question. Hi, guys. Thanks for all your hard work on the show. Listening to last week's show, I wondered if the panel thought that the iPad would really work properly in a professional photographer's workflow, and if yes, how would it need to change, or what would it need to do to be as important as other traditional equipment they would carry? Just asking. Thanks, Barry Gordon of Paul.
It's a good question.
Well, I would say there's a lot of things that you can do with an iPad that can aid a photography workflow. I wouldn't necessarily choose an iPad as my camera of choice, but you could use it for, you could use the camera for like some pre-visualization. So if you're just trying to kind of plan out a shot, you could use the camera to take some quick snaps and kind of think about, oh, does this look good? Does that look good? Is there some weird thing in the background I need to think about? But there's a lot of apps that kind of assist photographers. Like there's different apps that do help you like determine the position of the sun and the sky at a certain time. So you can think about like where your shadows are going to be and which angle you should shoot from. Apps that help you calculate like flash exposures or even manual exposures, depending on, you know, the kind of setup you're doing. There are, are apps that let you connect, like it'll connect wirelessly to your computer, and you've got a camera that's tethered, then you can control the camera remotely using the iPad screen. You can even like change the camera settings and snap the shutter and change the focus and stuff like that. So for someone that has an iPad and they're already a photographer and they like these kind of tools, it definitely fits in there. But I wouldn't necessarily say like, well, you have to have an iPod to be a good photographer.
Okay. I mean, I've got a couple of, I mean, I don't use one, but I've got a couple of uses which are leading to me towards using one. Is if I'm doing a room shot, as Chris said, in the old days, we used to fire off Polaroids. And I'll tell you what, a couple of packets of Polaroids, big Polaroids, weren't far off the cost of an iPad. That's how expensive that stuff was. And to be able to, I wouldn't necessarily use it to take the shot and have a look at, but I'd use it as a tethered screen to my DSLR so that I could see. I mean, one of the problems when you're doing a room shot is it's really hard to be in front of the camera and behind the camera at the same time. So if you've got a large enough screen, so when you're moving your lights around, you can see the effect it's having on the room shot that you're trying to prepare. It will save you, I mean, the difference between having taken a whole day to take one shot and getting it right and being able to do it in half an hour, that could be as much of a difference as it could make to your workflow. And, you know, if you can do something in half an hour and not waste a whole day doing it, it wouldn't take long to pay for the cost of the iPad. And the other thing, this is something I have considered quite a lot, is quite often when I do a lot of work and I'm away from home, there's a lot of nuances that I need to change because the actual situation was such where I wasn't physically able to get into the right place. I wasn't physically able to do quite a lot of things that I'd like to have been able to do. I get back and a lot of the things I do, I have to recolor maybe from memory, or I have to think, well, that side of the room or that side of the shot was a little bit lighter because there was a window and that color was blue and this and the other. If I could do some easy with some of the new apps they've got now, some easy photo editing, e.g. a little bit of color restoration. If I could do something that when I got home, I could look at it and that would be my reminder. That would be my, if you like, my artist doing a preparatory sketch of what I needed to do at home. That would also benefit me greatly because there's a few times I've changed things and I've gone back to the customer and they've said, that looks really good, but it didn't look like that because in my head it did. And that would be very useful. So there's two very, very good reasons that I could use an iPad.
How about you, Ewan? Is that new toy in the corner going to get some usage?
No, I think that the thing that Barry's trying to get into there is whether we'd actually use it for touching and that kind of stuff. And the answer would be no. I don't think I would. I wouldn't substitute Photoshop for that, or Elements even, or Aperture or Lightroom perhaps. But I'm with Alex on this. I think what I'd like to do is to be able to see things very quickly and get almost like the Wi-Fi thing, you know, what's it called? iFi. The iFi, yeah, exactly. Shoot across experience. But I think the problem there is iPad's got to embrace Bluetooth to cameras. Cameras have got to have Bluetooth antenna in them or Wi-Fi antenna, and they've got to hook up to the Wi-Fi. And there's got to be some kind of software on iPad that's willing to send stuff and retrieve stuff. Because getting files on and off iPads is a pain in the backside. You don't really want to be shoving in cards into readers that then shove in the bottom on a 30-pin connector. And I don't want all the photos that are on there. I want one, and I want a flash of it. And then when I finish looking at it, I want it to disappear. So I'd kind of prefer iPad to be more like a reflection of what flashes up on my screen at the back of my phone rather than it dealing with the file.
Mm.
So when I put it on play, I can kind of use it like an extension screen on AirPlay. That would be it. That would be the use case for me. But that's going to need a change in the camera as well as.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to using mine. Especially when we're going to Photo Walk, which leads me into the 24th. I think 24th of March. Next, LMUG, British Tech Network.
Well done.
Hey. Photo Walk in Camden, London. We haven't got specific details yet, even though it's getting very close, which is making me a bit nervous. But as soon as we get specific details, we will post it out on Twitter and you can come along and sign up and join us for the day touring Camden, where there's a few pubs, and apparently we're going to end up with some special ice cream parlour. Any of you guys heard of that?
No, I don't know. I have no idea what's coming onto this. So I want to be surprised on the day.
Oh, okay. Well, it's okay. But it's being led by Paul Kakao, who's the iPad artist at Elmo. So it should be a good day anyway. But as soon as we get the information up, we'll tweet out, I'm sure, and you can come and join us. This podcast and every other podcast on it on the new network name would not be possible without UK2.net. They make all our bandwidth woes, shall we say. Mm. Everything we share, they cover us all the way. They're a fantastic company, and they just keep us on the air. So if you could support us by supporting them, we'd be much appreciated. If you just go to our homepage and scroll down to their link, and anything you buy on there from their services, just enter the promotion code BagelTech, and you'll get 15% off anything you purchase. And if you use BagelTech DNS, they'll waive the transfer fees for any domains you want to bring in. It really is a fantastic service. And my favorite part of it is definitely still the site builder, where you can just, through a few clicks and a few alterations, you can build yourself a very good, decent-looking site indeed, and put your own photos on your own site. Can't get better than that. Mm. Guys, where can we get hold of you? Chris?
You can get a hold of me at the nearest hospital, where I'm going to go after I sign off and have my sinuses removed. I'm also on arstechnica.com, and where I spend most of my days writing about technology. And you can also find me on Twitter at Forsmac.
Okay, Chris. Ewan, where can we get hold of you?
You can get me at ewanrankin.co.uk for commercial photography work, or I'm on Twitter at British Tech News or at Ewan Rankin.
Okay, and last but no means least, Alex, where can we get hold of you?
You can get me on Twitter, Alex G. Fox. And very shortly, I'm going to get some of my old websites back. So I will be able to announce a website that actually might have some relevance to my name. And once that's done, that'll be, I might even start posting some work up there just you know, to prove that I actually am a photographer.
No more twitterything.com.
Oh, I've got that as well, but that's just a sideline.
Don't go down that route. I've had that in recent weeks. Just I feed my family. There's the proof.
There you go.
There you go. My name's Carl Madden. You can get me on Twitter at Claw0101, should you wish to. That's the new first show of the photo. Hang on, I'll get it right. I fluffed the ending. I got
the photo show.
The photo show from the British Tech Network. So that makes you an honorary Brit now, Chris.
Yeah.
Yay! Dual citizenship.
Kind of.
He's got a cold and he sounds miserable. He's halfway there.
We're looking for some bus spies over here, apparently, so. Yeah, it could be work. You came out with a good idea, so.
Thanks. Thanks for joining.
Sorry, I'm just American. I didn't know.
Oops.
Thanks for joining us, guys. Happy snapping. See you next time. Goodbye.
Bandwidth and hosting for Bagel Tech Photo is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting solutions.